sharp Q response at all on either one of them. And this is the first time I'm toying around with 3 gigs, so I know I'm doing something wrong.
Fine, Q.
Give me a quick description of the exciting probe inside of the coffee can. How many turns, what diameter, what length, what gauge wire? Over to you, John.
Okay, the coat hanger, which hangs down vertically, just as if you were to be looking at a broadside, it would look like an open delta. Each side of it was approximately 33 millimeters. The coil, which looked like a watch spring, also hangs down from the end connector and is coiled exactly like a watch spring, and that's about it.
Okay. You gave me some good clear words, but I didn't get a picture of what the thing looks like. Are you following somebody else's design, John, or is this a pure WGB, a brand new creation? Over to you, John.
No, this nightmare belongs to me. It's strictly myself. Alright, let me see if I can describe it a little better. Approximately 100 millimeters from the rear of the can, because I'm using that sort of as the reflector, I would hang the coat hanger, and it would be like broadside to you. You would actually see the shape of a delta if you look down the can. And the coiled-up watch spring is hanging broadside also, exactly the same, and both of them work basically the same.
Okay, I'm looking down the mouth of the can. I'm looking down the axis of the can. You told me I'm going to see a delta coat hanger, and I'm going to see a watch spring. My goodness, am I having trouble putting that together. Is one in front of the other at a different Z distance from the back end?
They're used independently.
Okay, they're used independently. When you're feeding the coat hanger, is the center conductor of the type N connector going to one lead of the coat hanger? And the coat hanger, I presume, is really a diamond-shaped, a triangular-shaped object. Is the far end of the triangle grounded? In other words, after the triangle makes its full loop, so to speak, you're feeding the center conductor of the type N connector to one end of that loop, and the other end is grounded to the can. Is that approximately it, John?
No, it's opened. The far end of that loop of the delta is opened. It's an open delta, and the same with the coil spring. It just ends in air.
Okay, and I think you said it's 100 millimeters on the side. And my goodness, that's around 4 inches. So it's 4 inches. I'm having trouble now. You told me 100 millimeters on the side. That would be 4 inches, if I got that right, yes?
No, it's the triangle or the coat hanger is 33 millimeters per side. The coiled watch spring is a total length of 100 millimeters.
Okay, you chose 33 millimeters on the side because three sides of 33 millimeters is going to be a total of 100. And is 100 millimeters a quarter wavelength at your operating frequency? Is that how you chose those dimensions?
I believe it's full wave.
I think you want that probe in the first resonant mode to be a quarter wave long. So it's a very unusual probe. I think my first suggestion, John, is to look at any of the better antenna books. There's quite a number of ways of lighting up a coffee can antenna. And by the way, are you seeking circular or linear polarization? Over to you, John.
I'm looking for linear polarization. Also, I did go on that website you had given me about horn designs and things like that. Very interesting website. I got a lot of information, and that's how I started this experiment. But maybe you're right. Maybe I should go down to quarter wavelengths instead. That might be easier to work with.
And when you said that website, that was either the WA1MBA, Dr. Tom Williams, or W1 Gigahertz, GHZ, which is Paul Wade. Was it the Paul Wade online book that you were looking at? Go ahead.
No, it was the
WB2XWW at a comment.
John, please say that again.
It was Dr. Williams.
Okay. Did you find one of the sub-articles from WA1MBA which gave you a design of a horn? The W1GHZ online book will give you quite a few articles, and I think, I wonder if you own any of the microwave handbooks of A.R. Arill. Over to you, John.
Not at this time, Dick. I don't. I should acquire them, though.
WB2XW, any comment?
The easiest way to light that horn would be a quarter-wave probe, approximately a quarter-wave from the end of the horn. In other words, from the center conductor of the type N connector, a simple piece of wire, straight, but where you want linear polarization, the easiest way to light up that horn is with a probe. And as you choose the bending of the probe forward and aft, in other words, closer to the back shorted end or further away from the shorted end, and the length of that probe, and the probe approximately a quarter wavelength long, 95% of a quarter wavelength long, you will hit resonance. That's the most dominant way that people light up a feed horn. Before I leave you, John, I wonder if you got a picture of what I'm saying. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
Yes, I do, Dick. I'll let it hang straight down, approximately a quarter wave from the rear, and then bend it either toward the rear or toward the front to achieve resonance. I'll try that next. And there was one other thing I wanted to say to you. Oh, I do not have an aperture on the front. It's just an open cylinder. I was going to cut the aperture later when I got to resonance. I don't know if that's going to make any difference.
You're doing exactly the right thing. An open-ended piece of waveguide, whether it be rectangular or circular, is an extremely good beginning antenna. Worst-case situation, if it was being fed with an ideal piece of round 4-inch waveguide, and you just simply open-end that piece of waveguide, you would have approximately a 1.5 standing wave ratio. A waveguide to coax adapter makes an extremely good sniffer antenna. Lots of people think that a waveguide to coax adapter has got to be connected to another piece of waveguide or it's going to explode. No such way about that at all. And then when you put the flare on the end of that piece of pipe in order to make it into a bigger horn, if you decide to do so, the only advantage you'll get out of that is a little bit more gain, a little bit more directivity, a little bit more narrow beam width if you want. As I said, the basic open circuited piece of waveguide is a 1.5 Vizwar, and even that Vizwar is thoroughly correctable as you make that probe a little bit longer and shorter, or a little bit tilted a little bit further forward or back. You can make it a 1-to-1 standing wave ratio antenna at your favorite frequency. So the most popular way is a simple quarter wave probe. I recommend you start off with that. The more elaborate techniques you are trying would be appropriate for something more sophisticated in circular polarization. I don't recommend you go there at first. And let us know how this turns out, John. Howie, make it brief. Go ahead with your comment. K2LIW.
Yeah, I think what he needs to do is hook up a return loss bridge or get a SiteMaster. If he has a spectrum analyzer with a generator built into it, with a tracking generator, he could use a return bridge and first find out where he's resonating at and see what his matches look like.
Where he's got a spectrum analyzer on another receiving device, that's an extremely sensitive thing. And by the way, what you think is resonance, the horn itself is an extremely broadband antenna, the way you're building it, John. You're not going to see a sharp resonance in frequency. In other words, as you tune across the 3 gigs and you go plus or minus half a gig from that, you're going to see an extremely broad curve. Don't let that discourage you. You want the horn to be broad, if you know what I mean. So, you would be able to tune for a best return loss ratio by way of a directional coupler, a Berg wattmeter, if you had one for that frequency, or some kind of a network analyzer, something that can measure reverse power. But these are the fine details, and you don't have to go that far at the very first, in my opinion, John. And so you're about to become a microwaver. We're going to have some fun with you. Okay, let's go over to the next person who signed in, which was Sam, KC2, Papa, Uncle, Yankee. Go right ahead, Sam, K2RIW in the TechNet.
I got a real quick comment for that station looking for the D-Star stuff.
Go right ahead, Barry.
Okay. K2KJI out of New Jersey does have a 1296 repeater. It's 1293050 minus 20. I thought that might help them.
Julio, did you copy on the HP?
very, very noisy, Rich. Okay, 1293050 minus 20 for probably the input, and that was Steve, KC2MDP. Do you need a fill on that, Steve?
No, I got it, Dick. Thank you very much.
Yeah, it looks like KJI is going to be your savior when it comes to D-Star. Okay, one more call to Sam, KC2 Papa Uncle Yankee. Go right ahead, Sam, K2RIW. Okay, maybe Sam got called away. We're a little bit beyond 9 o'clock, but it's time for the mailbag. Go right ahead, put Mel, K2 Kilo Echo Yankee. And you're sounding good tonight, K2RIW.
Dick, I got a comment on Gene, KJI.
Your signal, Rich, is so noisy, I don't think we're going to be able to hear it. Mel, go right ahead. K2KEY, K2RIW.
That was not me, Dick.
Your signal is extremely noisy. Mel, go right ahead with the mailbag.
Okay, this is K2KEY. All right, let's do just one here that's pretty straightforward, but I got a number of these from Philly, New Hampshire, and they seem to all be very worried about the same situation. And it boils down to this. My antenna is fairly new. It's a commercial dipole that I bought. It supposedly is all weather protected, new coax and all. Every time it rains or snows, I go crazy with the tuna. It seems like I have to play around, and I've made shots trying to show the different points when the weather conditions change, but yet every time it seems to be another situation. What can I do about this? Go ahead, Dick.
A little more power, Dick.
Yeah, if you're not in the high power mode, Mel, you might want to go there. You were 90% audio, 10% noise. Good sounding signal, but it wasn't your full power that you sometimes hit us with, and maybe it's conditions tonight. I presume we're talking about a high-frequency antenna, 80 through 10 meters, dipole-like, and there's a real art and science, so to speak, of how you protect the end of the cable to make sure water doesn't get in there on a wet day. So water getting into the end of the cable or water coming across your center insulator. I mean, a person might make the center insulator out of wood, and water could be sucked up with that in a worst-case situation. And the dipole itself, maybe it's strung in the trees, and it's laying alongside of some of the branches. And as the branches get wet, you'll get a lot of change in the tuning. So water is a biggie. Have any idea what frequency we're talking about for this particular dipole, and what's the construction of the dipole itself, Mel? K2KEY, K2RIW?
I'm up at full power, Mark, of 55 watts, and a little noisy tonight here. Conditions, I guess, just between us, I should say myself and the repeater. It's HF. This is that dipole that is put out by a company called, I know they make a fairly decent product. It's a sold by Radio Works, and they give you a sensor coax connecting device and all that. Very well waterproof, very well protected. Now it's up, he says, above the roof, and just held by a couple of supports, covers 10 through 40 meters, the popular version of their antenna. And he just that new coax, he says, bought the whole thing from them, which just comes as basically a package if you want it. And he says he's had a few other people that have similar problems with other antennas that not necessarily, in other words, it seems to be a problem that may show up on different configurations, different locations, but I don't think it has much to do with the trees, Dick, over.
And this is a bit of a mystery as I see it, Mel. You live in Manhattan Beach, a couple of blocks or a fraction of a block away from the water of the, it's not the Great South Bay, but you know what I mean, that local body of water, salt water. So you get all kinds of salt spray and high humidity. And my guess is your dipoles don't deviate very much. And one of your antennas is strung in a tree out front where the antenna itself is basically buried inside of the branches of the tree. You know, you're held off from the trunk of the tree by way of your PVC tubing, but still, if water is going to affect anybody's antennas, it's going to be affecting yours. So this is a bit of a mystery to me. What do you think, Mel? K2KEY, K2RIW?
Oh, one thing I will tell you, if you have, and I've had this in a past similar situation, where if your dipole antenna is not too far off the roof, let's say, you know, you put it up on a couple 10-foot poles to string it across the roof area, when that roof has a snow covering on it, or, you know, really well water saturated, you will see changes in the loading of the antenna. Definitely had that since back days of my novice days. I just scratched my head not knowing what the heck's going on. Looked at it over and over again, but never came up with the answer. So I think it's proximity at those frequencies. When you get down to like 40 meters, 20 meters, at those frequencies, it seems to be somewhat sensitive, especially when you're, you know, fairly close to the roof. These non-antennas, you know, they're putting them up, these, basically stringing them on two supports across the roof, only a few feet above the roof, maybe 10 feet on the average over.
Even with 10 feet of spacing, I'm amazed that we can get that much, let me call it capacitive loading or whatever. Where you saw the effect with your antenna on posts above the roof of the house, let me throw out a speculation here and see if you can confirm it. If the roof had conventional asphalt shingles, and the asphalt shingles are 15 years old, there's a lot of cracks in them. So on a rainy day, an awful lot of water soaks into the cracks of the asphalt shingles, a little bit like a sponge. It doesn't get past the tar paper that's between the shingles and the sheathing of the roof, the sheathing, the plywood, but water soaked into the cracks of the 15-year-old asphalt, and therefore it's like a sponge, and now it's a great big metallic, water-logged thing. Do you think there's a chance that that is creating the effect that you saw, Mel? And is there a way we can quantify this? In other words, if your antenna normally gives you a 1.2 standing wave ratio, on a wet day, did it give you a 1.5? Or did you have to take the tuning and loading controls of a Pi network and crank them to very different numbers? Back to you, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW. By the way, you sound quite good.
Well, my experiences were many, many years ago when we were youngsters. Ha ha. And now I haven't got any antennas that are close to my roof, so I haven't experienced recently, because the antennas now I have are up there considerable height. But I remember distinctly, and I thought it was just, you know, the material I used, but they were home-brewed, you know, they were just pieces of wire that I hung using many times. In fact, all the time, I never had coax until years after I had my ham license. You got to remember, back in my day of all homebrew, in the first few years of my ham radio, it was really a scrounge that whatever I found, I try to make use of. So most of this stuff was used stuff, especially wire and all. So I blamed it on that. You know, it was strung between my mother's clothesline pole, one support, and a part of the gutter area where there was like a nail pin in there. I mean, it was, you know, really something that a 13-year-old could put up, and that's what I was working with for a number of the first years. But I remember I used to diddle with the tuning all the time, diddling with the tuning, especially wet weather sometimes. I was only operating 1840 at that time, and I remember very critical at times tuning that so-called setup I had, Dick. But I used to scratch my head that normally I'd see a good heavy rainy day, snowy day, but today I'm not going to be able to do much. So there's something to it over.
When you said you're not able to do much, does that mean you ran out of range, out of the tuning and loading controls that you had in the shack? Because as long as you can bring it back into reasonable tuning and loading, the fact that it tunes differently is curious, but that doesn't stop the operation. As long as your controls don't run out of range and the transmitter is not seeing a 4-to-1 standing wave ratio, I think you can go right on and operate. Over to you, Mel.
Oh, you got to remember, I didn't even have my so-called transmitter of the day. I at first did those. I didn't even have anything to indicate what the heck was going on there because I didn't have a meter, really. My homebrew meter, as I described one time, when I had a 0 to 1 millionth meter that I picked up a movement, and I had resistance hanging on it all over the place, and the batteries, and everything. It was a breadboard, BOM. So occasionally, you know, when I suck it in to see what the heck's going on, maybe the plate voltage or whatever heck, I surmised it was right by comparing it to, I know, oh, I said my reference would be a 90-volt B battery, and then I say, well, it's reading quarter scale, so if I read three times that, you know, what the plate voltage would be three times, that may be 270 or whatever heck, that's the way I did it. And my SWR indicators, I mean, just give you an idea what life was like. My FWR indicator with two number 47 light bulbs on the line, over.
Wow. And I thought I started off with simple equipment. I guess I also did. When it comes to volt-ohm milliammeters, a basic meter for the shack, ever since the middle 1940s or 1950s, there were two respected brand names, Triplett and Simpson. Triplett and Simpson made beautiful, rugged, volt-ohm milliammeters with a 50 microampere meter movement. I now know there was a third brand. There was a third brand that used a 1 milliampere meter movement instead of a 50 microampere and a whole bunch of resistors on a board, and that was the Schneider brand of volt-ohm milliammeter. For how many years did you use that? My goodness, were you enthusiastic. Over to you, Mel.
I was 13 years old, you know, I was doing everything by what I had in that book. You remember the book they used to, ARL used to send you a book for your child, how to become a ham radio, how to become an amateur radio operator, something like that. They have these pamphlets gave out. In fact, I think RCA used to give them out. You went down to Cortlandt Street, you were for the picking, you pick up these things and how to get you on the air, you know, and everything. And, yeah, of course. I used that for a couple of years because until I, you know, got up a little in the world that I was able to get something. I had no money, absolutely no money. When I first, what am I going to go through my life history? But to say, when I went to Brooklyn Tech, I had to come up with money for car fare for the other little odds and ends. And thank God I got a little job in a radio store on Friday afternoons and Saturday and made myself $10. And that kept me in whatever I needed. But there was no money at home, especially for frivol fees like ham radio, over.
Well done. And that really does prove the craftiness of a ham radio operator. A guy in a very well-equipped laboratory will have Hewlett-Packard brand, Agilent brand, Donovan Golan, Schwartz, Rode and Schwartz, you know, very elaborate $30,000 pieces of test equipment for a spectrum analyzer, a vector network analyzer, and whatever. It's very nice to have all that equipment. But a crafty ham radio operator with very simple meters, diode detectors, and maybe an oscilloscope can do an awful lot of those measurements. Not exactly traceable to the bureau. You don't need 1% accuracy to know your antenna is working. 10%, 20% accuracy in many cases is more than enough. So crafty ham radio operators using straight pins and straws and rubber bands and chewing gum have made all kinds of sensitive instrumentation that was good enough. In the case of twin lead transmission line, let me drop. There was a very popular technique of taking a parallel piece of transmission line with the ends shorted and a parallel piece of twin lead transmission line. You essentially tape it to the main transmission line, and in the middle of one of the legs, you put a pair of 47 light bulbs. And one of those light bulbs tells you how much relative power was going forward and how much relative power the other light bulb lighting would tell you how much relative power was coming backwards. Your reflective power ratio, so to speak. That's a poor man's standing wave ratio. That was a somewhat popular technique in the middle 40s. And nowadays, we don't know about those very simple techniques. You read about how people used to measure frequency by way of Letcher wire, which really was an open wire line with a sliding short and a neon bulb, and you would slide the slider, the shorting on the open wire line until you got the light bulb to light, and you measured the wavelength directly on the Letcher wire system. So the 20-meter band, where a quarter wavelength of 20 meters would be 5 meters, if 5 meters of open wire line resonated at your frequency, you knew you were on the 14 or 15 megacycle M band, so to speak. So things like that, that's why we call it the 20-meter band, because in the early days, measuring frequency was very difficult. Nowadays, a modern-day frequency counter, simple as all heck. In those days, you measured the wavelength to know what band you were on. Do you want to go to another one of your mailbag letters, Mel? K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, apropos to what we were discussing a little earlier. Look at this, got one here. Should hands use a bleeder resistor across the antenna feed point of their antenna to ensure that their antennas have no static buildup? And if so, what type of resistor should I have? I have a 100-watt HF transceiver that's fairly new, and I'd like to make sure it's protected. There you are, Dick. There's the question. It came up earlier, over.
When it comes to lightning protection, the nicest thing to do if you're using coax cable is that the outer shield of the coax cable should eventually connect somewhere to, let me pick a number, a piece of 8-gauge or so, 6-gauge wire that goes to a grounding rod outside of the shack is one way, or to a copper water pipe that's in the house is probably good enough. So that so that static pickup on the outside of the coax cable finds an easy way to ground. Now, if that coax cable is feeding a dipole, you have to worry about voltage being built up on the center conductor. The nicest way to make sure that voltage is not put on the center conductor is a simple RF choke. An RF choke is an inductor with enough inductance that goes literally from the center conductor to the shield, probably inside of one of your pieces of equipment is the convenient way to do it, and that provides a direct DC short circuit. Any static buildup, when a dry wind blows across your antenna and it starts building up thousands of voltage on the antenna, and maybe one side of the dipole versus the other side of the dipole, that particular source of signal has very little current capability. A microampere or so is all it's capable of supplying. So therefore, a simple RF choke, and how do you choose that RF choke? By the formula where you know how to calculate inductive reactance. If you're operating at 14 megacycles, you can calculate how many microhenry of choke will act like an open circuit to the 14 megacycles, but it'll be a direct short circuit to the DC voltage that Mother Nature is trying to build up with your antenna as a static charge. Let me drop. So when you've got a 50-ohm system and you want the RF choke to not change the tuning of your system, to choose the right amount of inductive reactance, in other words, 2 pi, the inductive reactance, X equals 2 pi FL, 2 times pi times frequency times inductance in henries, and you can solve for how many henries, which is really going to be microhenries, gives you, let me pick a number, 500 ohms of inductive reactance. Nothing magic about that number. Because your antenna, in my example, is a 50-ohm piece of coax, if you shunt that 50-ohm piece of coax additionally, as well as the antenna, with a 500-ohm inductive reactance choke, that's a very minor perturbation to the system. Make it 5,000 ohms if you want to be, in other words, 10 times more henries, microhenries. So by putting an RF choke, a It's a very safe thing to do in your antenna tuner or in the output of your transmitter, and make sure that the RF choke is capable of handling the voltage. No real significant current will flow through that choke. It only has to have enough spacing of the windings so that it can tolerate the amount of voltage your transmitter is going to put into that 50 ohm line. So an RF choke is the Cadillac way of doing it. You could also doing it with a, let me pick a number, a 1,000 ohm resistor. And now, once you know how many volts you're loading into, or maybe it could be a 10,000 ohm resistor, but once you know how many volts you're putting into your transmitter because you know how many watts at a 50 ohm line, and now you want to calculate how many watts will that resistor dissipate, E squared over R, voltage is E, RMS voltage, divided by the resistance in ohms, that tells you how many watts that resistor, and probably a 1-watt resistor is more than enough. The nice thing about the RF choke is that it really shorts out any DC, and it dissipates no power. An ideal RF choke would...
repeater, timeout, cancel.
In that environment, an RF choke, a good RF choke, would run ice cold. I bet you've put RF chokes because you can build up some pretty nice static charges when you're at your seaside QTH. I bet you've got RF chokes or bleeder resistors on many of your antenna systems or in the actual equipment that's in the shack. Is that true, ML? K2KEY, K2RIW?
Okay, let me boil this down, what Dick has just said, because I'll get questions galore. What you are basically trying to do to protect yourself is provide what is known as a DC path to ground that doesn't shunt your RF, basically. So there's two ways of doing it. My way, I'll tell you what I do. I never leave the equipment connected to my antennas when not in use, and of course I will never operate when there's a thought or a warning that we're going to have lightning conditions. Not worth it. You can't get anything that's going to protect you 100%. The best thing to do is to provide the CC path. What I do, I disconnect the antenna. The antennas go right to a ground bus bar. I actually have PL-259s that are grounded onto a plate. In other words, the same where your antenna connects onto your radio, you know, there's sockets called the SO-239 where you screw them on. I got them separate, a panel like that with a ground that goes directly to ground. Let me let it drop and I'll say a few more words.
Like, no, if you use a switch, Mel.
No, there are no switches. You just take the cable, and I screw it right onto that. It only takes a second. And I know that positively off the equipment. Also in the shack, as Dick was alluding to earlier about the 110-volt line, when I pop the switch, pull my switch in the shack, both AC lines, well, I should say actually three. I got neutral, and I got the 220-210. It is broken away from all the equipment from the console. The sides that are broken away that go to the equipment, they also go to ground. And I leave the open connections from the power, of course, the 210 plus the neutral, they're just floating. But that is, yes, you can put resistors and things like that, but be careful even with resistors and these lightning arresters and things and all. You got to remember, though, let me say a word about resistors. You got to remember stuff like half-watt resistors, for instance, that are used in a lot of these lightning devices or whatever. Their rating, actually, a half-watt resistor only has a rating of like 350 volts. While the 1-watt resistors have a rating around 500, what we call VA. Rob, hold on. So, you know, again, no use really getting into a lot of different situations of buying some of these gadgets. For me, the simplest system of all is just as I described, disconnect. And you know then you are as safe as possible. That's my bottom line, Dick. Over.
Yeah, that certainly is a belt and suspenders approach. What Mel is literally doing, may have made it clear is he unscrews each of his coax cables from the back panel of each one of his transmitters and receivers. And then that cable, he physically moves it over to this great big grounding panel he's got against the wall. It's got its own great big heavy wire going to a grounding rod, and it's got a bunch of sockets, and he takes each one of those coax cables that he has unscrewed from the back of his transmitter, and he takes that exact same cable and re-screws it into this grounded connector that's on this metal plate. So all of his coax cables are going to a shorting network, and they're all connected to this plate, and the plate in turn is connected to the ground. And because he gets some pretty wicked lightning by his Seaside QTH, that's a very safe thing to do. For the 40 years that I've lived on top of the hill in Huntington, I have never disconnected any of my cables, from any of my pieces of equipment. I'm not recommending that you do what I do. I'm just telling you what I've done. And lucky for me, I've never suffered any damage of any of my pieces of electronics. So on that one lightning strike I did have that day, which I think was the nearby telephone pole, not my tower itself, although maybe the tower was struck, because I did tell you that the return wire on the 110-volt wiring on the shack, that particular wire became an open circuit somewhere between my shack and in the BX cable all the way back to the main fuse panel of the house. That became an open circuit, and I had to bypass it, put in another parallel line. And lots of other electronics in the living room and dining room and kitchen got damaged, but none of the ham equipment got damaged, which is kind of amazing to me. So completely moving the cables is the double-don, belt and suspenders technique, and that's what Mel does. Anybody with any...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Anybody with any further comments on lightning arresting techniques that they've used, give me a call, let us right now. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Oh, and final, let me just say, the panel that I just mentioned, that's grounding the antennas, I leave my antennas on there. I only take the one off, the cable off that I'm going to use. I'm only going to use one antenna usually at a time. So I leave them all there. They're always there. And I pull off of them. I'm going to use like the 20-meter beam. I take the one off, the 20-meter beam off, and I use it. I'm finished. I put it back right to the side to go over to 80 meters. Take the 80-meter one off, connect it to the equipment. Otherwise, it's always on that ground panel, Dick. Over.
Question, Dick. Go ahead, John. I'd like to know if Mel has a patch panel made up in the back, or does he actually go to the back of each receiver, because that sort of beats up the SO239s and the others.
Yeah, but he's not beating them up every day. In other words, he only disconnects from his grounding panel the one that's on the band he's about to use that particular day. Over to you, Mel.
Okay, let me describe it. No, I don't go to the back of the rig. What I do is I have from the back of the rig, or whatever setup it is, it goes to a panel that I have that they have the 239s. And actually what I'm doing, let me describe it basically what I'm doing. I'm taking the antenna off the ground panel, and I'm going to the second panel right next to it. The panel right next to it, each one of those SO239s goes from a cable to the approximately... directly to the piece of equipment to one of my radios. So in other words, I'm taking the antenna and I'm connecting it from one panel to another panel. I'm not creeping behind the consoles each time. They have a short cable come from each piece of equipment to this panel with the 239s on it, and the other panel is the ground panel. So I'm just taking the cable off from there and screwing it on. I don't know. I've had them on and off so many times now. I don't see anything wrong with the connectors. I don't think they've worn out any appreciably, Dick. Over.
Let me ask you this, Mel. What motivated you to do all of this belt and suspenders grounding technique for all of your coax cables? Had you not done that in the past and experienced some damage? Or is it just something you decided to do just to be sure? Was there a previous event that motivated you to do this? Because what you're doing is a little more enthusiastic than most of us do. Over to you, Mel.
Seen firsthand what lightning can do. Let me tell you something. that would stand there and scratch your head and say, this is really possible. I mean, if the walls burned up and all. So with the location I was, contemplating when I was moving in here, and I said to myself, if I'm going to put up a tower and everything, I got to think this out very carefully about all possibilities here. And one of the things that, of course, pop into your head, first of all, is this closeness to the ocean here. And so the tower is, I got ground rods down. I got these 9-foot ground rods down all over the place, all connected together in number 6 wire. I mean, not just connected, they're braised together. The wire is underground. And it's all in a fixed, ring-like, and it terminates at the leg of the tower. And underneath the tower, in fact, straight down underneath the tower, I put a ground rod. Up at the top of the tower, above the top beam, there's a mast that sends up above the top boom. That's 5 feet, and on top of it, it's got a porcupine, a spike, a sharpened pin that's a desensitizing. So I have taken, taken the brute force, thinking out that what is the best way, and not be lazy, and, not possibly letting any chance of getting myself into problems here, especially with a lightning. I saw it get hit. Now, you talk about the power. I saw it get hit one day, so help me God, 3 times. A storm hung over here, and wham, wham, wham. I said, and the tower was ringing. I said, if this thing don't come down, it's a miracle. And what saved it is that pin on top, I'm sure, that desensitizing setup, Dick, over.
I knew you would have more lightning than me, but I'm amazed at what you just described. Where were you when you saw the lightning strike the top of the tower? Obviously in the house, looking out the window, I'm guessing. And because you cared about your tower, you're staring at the top of the tower during this thunderstorm. Wow. And the nice thing about direct strike on the tower, when you've got these individual cables grounded the way you got them grounded, I suspect that the 110-volt wiring of the house may have brought in some electromagnetic pulse from a nearby lightning strike, and that could have possibly done some damage to other pieces of electronics in the living room, so to speak. But have you suffered any damage of any of your ham radio equipment with your procedure? I'll bet you the answer is no. And where were you when you saw those lightning strikes? That sounds like an exciting thing to see. Back to you, Mel.
Sure, I didn't go outside. I was inside, and you could see the flashes in the window. You could see actually the reflection of the flash, and you could actually feel this vibration, this intense, vibration that you get. It's a strange feeling. And nope, never suffered. I'll tell you what, the funniest thing. The antenna rotor, the fuse was blown inside the antenna control box. Why that blew, I have no idea. How the heck did that? But when I went to turn the box on, nothing happened. I opened it up, and there, sure enough, the fuse was blown in there. But other than that, no problem in the house or whatever. In fact, I people around here and I say, you see? I said, that saved us. Oh, the lightning here. I said, oh, yeah. I said, this is my lightning the rest of the saves this neighborhood and area around here. So, it becomes a wonderful thing to, behold that the extra protection we're getting. But my daughter, Julie, for school once made a very interesting, we used to get these storms right off the coast here in the summertime. Let me tell you what she did. Set up a videotape camera, that's fine. Right in here in the front of the house, we have these windows, a bunch of windows in the front of the house that sort of juts out that, you can look at one side and it looks right straight at the ocean. And she set up that videotape camera, and we were watching the strikes hitting the ocean one after, you could sometimes really see some show out there. Of course, in the summertime, they clear the beach. Anytime there's any lightning, they stop blowing the wind, so everybody off the beach. They've had a couple casualties, unfortunately. And after she took all these, you know, a whole bunch, and she edited them together, so it was one strike after another, and she dragged it to school and played the tape and telling the kids what was going on, and, you know, with the noise that turned up the audio and everything like that, it was quite a program that she produced. But you sure do see plenty of it at times by the ocean during the summers on July and August. We become like Florida, the lightning capital of the world over.
Wow. I knew you would have more than me. I didn't realize it was that much. And me living on the top of a fairly high piece of land, Long Island standards-wise, and then 100 feet of steel tower sticking out of the top of that land with 85-foot high trees around it, I assumed that I was going to be the local lightning arrestor for the community. And during that one lightning strike, which hit a power line, is what I believe happened, and quite a few of my neighbors also had hi-fi systems and television sets and things like that, and computers that were damaged, as I did, but never the ham radio equipment. Yeah, lightning is pretty wicked stuff, and a ordinary lightning bolt is in the vicinity of 11,000 amperes. That's if it is a negatively charged cloud, and 90-some-odd% of the time, the bottom of the cloud is negatively charged. But a few percent of the time, Mother Nature does it upside down, and the bottom of the cloud becomes positively charged. And positive lightning is at least 10 times greater. Every so often you'll hear a thunderstorm where you know that each one of those lightning bolts sounds extremely loud compared to anything you've ever heard before. That's the so-called positive lightning. And many of them are over 100,000 amperes. And can they do damage? Wow. And can they, are they lethal if they happen to hit a human being? So a certain number of people are struck with lightning every year, and quite a few of those people suffer some damage, but quite a few of them survive. But when it comes to those positive lightning bolts, look out. Hey, with any further comments or questions on the subject of lightning and antennas, give me a call that is right now, K2RAW on the TechNet.
Who are we out there?
Go ahead, Rich.
After I had an antenna hit, like I said earlier, like 6 or 7 years ago, I had some ground bus behind the equipment, and everything was tied together. All the equipment went to the bus, and the bus went to a water pipe. And now that I've got the tower up, I'm doing even more extensive work. I've got two rods, the 10-foot rods, in front of the house, back of the house, that were driven down with a Hilti by an electrician. I have conduit running up the side of the house with, I forget what gauge, but I got the wire from Glenn Martin Engineering, who makes the tower, because I figured they're not going to sell me the wrong stuff because there's liability issues. I also have, let me go to reset. I also have what Mel has, a sharp spike at the very top of the mast. It's the highest thing above the upper antenna. And I have a wire coming down and bonds to the tower, and then two wires go from the tower, one to the front of the house, one to the back of the house. And what I'm in the process of doing now, I got a picture of the console that was built. It's on QRZ, if you look me up. And what I'm doing is installing ground buses behind everything. Started it last fall. I'll finish it up, hopefully, before the lightning season. Because what you want is, what I've been told, you want all the equipment tied together so if there is a lightning strike, everything rises equally and there's no potential difference, i.e. voltage, between the equipment. I felt I was very, very lucky with the grounding I had. That strike only destroyed the switch in the Ameritron tuner. Dick, I want to go into this more in depth in the next week or two on lightning. And I think it's something that a lot of people forget about. And to Leo.
Comment, Dick.
Yeah, I think you got a good point there, Rich, that many of us sort of ignore lightning. A direct hit to an antenna is fairly rare because the real metal in a community is the power wiring. But occasionally it does happen, and you got to prepare for it. KC2WGB, go ahead, John. K2LIW.
Yes, Dick, I just want to remind people they're using the cold water pipes for grounds. They must put a jumper across the water meter now. The new water meters have the plastic ferrules in them, and the impedance is quite high. So that's something they want to check, like a number 8 wire from one side of the water meter with secure clamps to the other side, and that'll solve that problem.
Wow, I didn't realize the water meter is plastic. In my case, the water meter is out in front of the house, very close to the road, and that makes it over 100 feet away. So I've got 100 feet of pipe buried in the ground. What is it now? 3/4 inch in my case, 3/4 inch K-pipe, I think it's called, thick-walled K-pipe. And so that water meter that the water company reads is in a trap door in the ground, close to the road, close to 100 feet from the house, 80 feet or so. I guess you're saying there are houses with the water meter either in the house or very close to the house, and because of plastic inserts, you're saying the water meter itself is an insulator between the rest of the system. Now, my main main out in front of the house that runs parallel to the street looks like it's made out of concrete. So in my case, if my water meter was made out of plastic, and on the far side of that, a couple of feet away, it's going to join a concrete pipe, what looks like concrete. I may be wrong on that one. Give us some more words on this one, John. Back to you, John. K2LIW.
K2LIW.
Yeah, Bernie recognized, but John first. Go ahead, John.
Yes, Dick, it's not that the water meters are made out of plastic. They're still brass-based, but the ferrules that they put in, instead of using the ferrules that were copper, which crushed and made a watertight seal, a lot of them are using plastic now, and that raises the impedance of the meter. And you're right, some of the concrete pipes, there's not too many of those being used. They're like that corporation pipe. They have a metal pipe with the concrete around it. But I'm surprised. Usually they use copper, like a copper tubing. It's a very thick wall. And that's probably what you have.
Yeah, I did see them dig a hole and establish another service for a brand new house that was built across the street. And I saw them actually tap into the pipe live, if you know what I mean. There was a way they could tap in and then establish the pipe, and very little water leaked into the hole during the whole installation process. And the main that they tapped into looked like it was concrete. But the more I think about it, that doesn't make sense. You wouldn't get a good watertight seal. So it's concrete covered, or some kind of a fancy covering outside of what probably is a steel or copper pipe. N2YO, here we go. K2YO. Go ahead, Bernie. K2YIW on the tech net.
Good evening, Dick, from the net. Two questions, or a comment first. At our building in Queens, the water meter is inside the building. It's absolutely inside the building. John, did they change your water meter? We've gotten a notice that they wanted to change our water meters to the ones they can remotely read. And then the second question, does anybody know if there are any code issues about basically grounding across your water meter? Are there any issues about putting a double-aught wire across it to keep the ground central in that?
Yeah, Don, good question. Over to you, John.
Yes, I have recently had a water meter installed because we were metered by frontage. We didn't have water meters originally on Staten Island. But yes, you're right. They are mounted inside, like mine is mounted inside, and there's no code except you're supposed to have 25 ohms to ground minimum on your electrical service before Edison, at least in Staten Island, will allow you to use it. But now, because of these problems with PVC piping and stuff, they've gone to a ground rod beside the ground to the water main. Also, we've had a few of the water department people that were injured, a couple killed, when they were cutting the water main, and you had an unbalanced current in the house. The neutral was carrying current, and they got fried. So that's why they're requiring separate ground rods now in every new installation.
MCO. Rich recognized, but Bernie first. Go ahead, Bernie, because you started this question.
Very interesting. I didn't even think about the safety issue for the water department personnel. That's very real also. Okay. Well, I think I'm going to schedule a phone call to our electrician as soon as they get in to change the water meter. They'll call the electrician and come take a look at it. Thanks, Dick.
Yeah, as soon as Rich gives us his comment, I'm gonna tell you about what I believe is electrocuting water people. N2EO, go ahead. K2RIW on the TechNet.
Okay, Dick. What Bernie said with John, ground wires, rather ground rods and a jumper, is this something that John or you know, Dick, that a Con Edison will do was to hire an electrician? In other words, if I call the Con Edison business office and tell them that I'm using the ground for an antenna system as well as for their safety ground, and that I'm water, because we have the same thing, but we had water meters put in a number of years ago. Now they upgraded them to the one that they can read remotely, you know, by radio. Will Con Edison oblige to do that as a maybe for liability reasons, or do I have to call an electrician?
Yeah, all of this is not clear, but let me show you what the source of the problem is. And it's happened in my neighborhood on a couple of occasions, and I'll bet you on many of the neighborhoods that are in the sound of my voice you've had this problem. In many cases, the high voltage wiring that goes down each one of your streets for distribution is what they call 13.2 kilovolts line to line, 7,800 volts each line to ground. And there's usually three of those lines, phase A, phase B, phase C. Your particular drop transformer, pole pig transformer, that's on top of the utility pole, essentially in front of your house, is connected to one of those phases, 7,800 volts to ground, and that lead, that let's say the A phase goes into your transformer. The grounding of the transformer that completes the primary circuit is supposed to go down a piece of what looks like 6-gauge wire that goes down as a wooden truss down the side of the utility pole and picks up the butt plate, a great big copper plate that's on the bottom of the telephone pole before the telephone pole was installed in the ground. That's the way the primary circuit of the transformer is completed. However, the outer case of that transformer on the top of your utility pole is the thing that gets grounded by that lead that goes to the butt plate. It also is common with the center tap of the secondary. The secondary is 240 volts approximately, 230 volts, across the secondary winding with center tap that is also brought to the case of the pole pig transformer. And now there are three wires that come into your house. The so-called center tap, which they call neutral, and the what some people call the red wire and the black wire, 115 volts each side to ground. So you've got three wires coming into your house, and that center tap wire should also be grounded to the house.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
So that center tap wire is grounded to the house ground, which in many cases in the older houses was the copper water pipe system. My local power company did not, at the time of my house was constructed in the late 50s, did not put a separate ground rod. The copper water pipe was the grounding system, and so the main fuse panel has that third wire coming into the house, the neutral wire, and that connects to a water pipe. If, as that telephone pole in front of my house has been hit on about five occasions, on some of those occasions, when the telephone pole has been hit with a car and damaged, and someone replaced the telephone pole, for reasons that are unknown to me, they didn't reestablish that wiring to the butt plate, and therefore the completion of the primary circuit, the 7,800 volts to ground, on each of the primary winding was being picked up